University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your host, Paul McDivitt, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. Today we have a special episode of the podcast. Extension educator Greg Klinger will facilitate a discussion about the Root River Field-to-Stream Partnership in Southeast Minnesota. He's joined by Kevin Keener from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Ron Miners, retired Root River Soil and Water Conservation District Manager. Greg, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the partnership?
Sure. Thanks, Paul. I'm an extension educator with the University of Minnesota. I really focus on nutrient management in my work, and especially on how different nutrient management practices on farms can affect water quality. And I also live and work in Rochester in the southeast part of the state. For anyone who's listening and hasn't been down to this southeast corner of the state, I'm pretty biased, but I'd say it's a really special area. We have lots of big hills and bluffs, sinkholes, caves. Also have lots of corn and cows as well. And we're lucky to have some of the most agriculturally productive soils in the world, really. But our soils also tend to be both highly erodible, and our groundwater is unfortunately fairly easily contaminated, which really brings us to the Root River Field-to-Stream Partnership. A little background on this project, and our guests can correct me if I'm missing any of this. But since around 2008, our guests today have been monitoring the water quality of streams and groundwater in these three different, fairly small watershed areas that are located within the larger Root River watershed that's in the southeast corner of the state. And they're looking at things like soil, phosphorus, nitrogen moving through those watersheds. Now, at the same time as this water monitoring has been ongoing, our guests have also gotten to know just about every farmer that farms in those small watersheds, and have worked together with them to see if there are any management changes on their farms that they can make that might improve water quality in their area. And this project it's really quite unique, certainly in Minnesota and perhaps in the country, because it includes almost 100% of the farmers and the acres within those watersheds. You get to see not only, okay, what the current impacts are from agriculture in those watersheds, but also how those impacts change both over time and with changes in how the land is managed. And because of this project, we all have a better sense now of where we're at in terms of nutrient and soil losses from agriculture, and also how soil, phosphorus, nitrogen can move from farm fields in some pretty unexpected and surprising ways. So we'll discuss some of that today. All right, guys, you want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Kevin Keener, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and based in Preston, which is about 45 minutes south of Rochester, and grew up in northeast Iowa, a dairy farm, and been working in soil and water conservation and water quality work for the past 20 or so years, and in my current position with the Department of Agriculture, I'm a hydrologist, and I'm in the Clean Water Technical Unit, so a lot of the work that we do is working with farmers, crop advisors, and other partners to better understand practices that can improve water quality, and a lot of our work is on-farm types of demonstration work, and the Root River Field-to-Stream is a good example of that.
I'm Ron Miners. I'm a lifelong resident of southeast Minnesota. Grew up farming, and we had an active beef and hog farm down in southeast Minnesota. And so then I took a job with the Root River Soil and Water Conservation District about 25 years ago, and worked there until retirement, and then took this private contracting job with the Department of Ag, working on the Root River Field to Stream project. And so I'm busy with this project, and I've enjoyed the project, and I look forward to seeing the outcomes.
Great. So I think the first thing I'd be curious to hear about is how this project actually started.
Yeah, so this project started a little over probably about 9 years ago, or 10 years ago now. Basically a small group of us got together to help answer some very basic but important questions about water quality here in southeast Minnesota. And in my years of working in various watershed projects across the state, you know, one of the first things when we start to engage farmers on some of these water quality challenges that we have is, you know, there's a lot of very important questions that arise during those discussions. And one of them being just, you know, what are the relationships between agricultural practices and water quality? How much soil are we losing? When are we losing it? And so looking back about 10 years ago, we didn't really have very good answers to those questions. And so this project really came about as a need to provide, you know, additional science-based information and helping provide some of those answers to some of those questions. It's a unique in that it's made up of a lot of different groups, both private and public, ranging from the various state agencies, University of Minnesota and Extension, and Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, Board of Water and Soil Resources, of course, our farmers here, and local soil and water conservation district offices, and then we also the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Center, which makes up represents a lot of the most of the commodity groups here in Minnesota, has been a valuable partner, and we also have the Nature Conservancy has been a part of this from the beginning as well. So but really the ultimate goal when we started this back 10 years ago was to really focus in on three main questions. The first question was just simply, what is the range of sediment and nutrient losses coming from representative farming systems and small watersheds here in southeast Minnesota? Number two, the second question we had is, how effective are existing practices that farmers are using and new practices that farmers are employing on their farms? And then the third and last question was more of a long-term question, but just to try to answer this question about what are the long-term trends and relationships between ag practices and water quality. And so with the way we organized the study is to basically break it into the three main phases. So the first phase is an 8-year, what we call benchmarking or baseline period, which is just to answer the question, what is the water quality like today? And we just recently completed that phase of the study. The second phase of the study is to work with farmers and landowners within these particular study areas and to target additional practices and to see what effect that may have on the water quality. And then the third phase is just to continue the monitoring to measure the performance of those practices. The way we kind of designed the study was to selected the Root River watershed, which is a very large watershed. It covers over 1 million acres in southeast Minnesota. It covers spans 6 different counties. And it's a very large, complex watershed and probably one of the more complex watersheds in the state. And the reason for that is because of the geology that we have here with the thin soils and over fractured bedrock. But we also have areas of the watershed that benefit from subsurface tile drainage. So we have kind of a mix of both poorly drained soils and very well-drained soils. And we also get the most amount of precipitation throughout the state. So runoff and flooding and movement and transport of nutrients and other contaminants is, of course, a primary concern for residents down here in southeast Minnesota. So because of the size of that watershed, over 1 million acres, what we did is we selected three very small sub-watersheds within the greater Root River watershed that represents each of these kind of unique landscapes. And so starting from the west to the east, over in the Maurer County area near the headwaters of the Root River, we selected a small watershed what represents what we call the glacial till area. And so this area basically is relatively flat, typically less than 2% slopes. The area typically has a very poorly drained soils, so they benefit from subsurface tile drainage. Typically corn, soybean rotation. Average field size is about 140 acres over in that area. Not as much livestock production, typically just commercial fertilizer in that area. The second watershed that was selected represents what we call our karst area. And that's an area that would basically kind of be the corridor along Highway 52, if you're familiar with that, in the southeast corner of the state. And this area is, again, a small watershed, less than about 4,000 acres in size, and a good mix of corn, soybeans, and alfalfa, and also a mix of both hog and dairy production in that watershed. The last watershed represents the bluffland area, and that's closer towards the Mississippi River, and it's the very similar to the karst. It's just that we have much steeper topography, smaller field size, and kind of a little bit more mixture of alfalfa, small grains, and then also more forested area over in that location. So I always kind of use the roads, Highway 63, again, kind of being the corridor in the far western part of the watershed, being the till, Highway 52 being the karst area, and then Highway 43 being the area that represents more of our bluffland area.
Great. I'm also curious, these small watersheds represent larger areas, a very horizontal, very flat landscape. I always describe it as going from horizontal to vertical, depending on where you are in the watershed. But, a flat landscape in the west, it's much larger than this small watershed to a more forested steep landscape in the east, which is, again, much larger than the study area. So what I'm curious about is, how did you end up picking or falling into specific watersheds to do this study versus other ones that are equally representative of that particular area?
Yeah, so how these study watersheds were selected were really based on a couple of main criteria. Number one, they had to be a relatively small size. We were shooting for less than 5,000 acres, and the main reason for that is when you're conducting a water quality study, you want to try to minimize the amount of variables that are involved, and so smaller is better that way. And plus, it's just more manageable working with a smaller group of farmers rather than a much larger group of farmers. And the other factor was we had to be able to monitor it. And not all watersheds you can actually monitor, because we have to have access to the stream itself, or the outlet of that watershed where all that water gets collected and conveyed. And so we have to usually have a road access with the culvert that we can actually measure the quantity of the water coming out of the watershed, so we can actually calculate how many pounds or mass of sediment or nutrients are coming out of the watershed. And then proximity to Preston was another factor. We didn't want to get too far away because just logistics of getting samples to the labs. Out of the, I would say, probably 30 or 40 potential watersheds, it really narrowed down pretty quickly based on those criteria. And there's probably only maybe 10 that we could actually select. And these happen to be the watersheds that met a lot of those criteria. And we really didn't know any of these landowners to start with. And so we were kind of really starting from a blank slate. But the other really critical factor was that it had to represent what we felt was representative of those each of those unique landscapes, the till, the karst, and the bluffland. And by doing that, even though these watersheds represent only less than 1% of the area of the whole entire root, by strategically selecting these watersheds, we can take what we're learning from these and then apply it to other very similar landscapes throughout much of southeast Minnesota. So for instance, the Cannon River watershed to the north, or the Zumbro, that have very similar landscapes and farming systems, we can apply these data to those areas as well.
So I guess another question I have about this initial process of setting up this project. How did, actually, let me take a step back and rephrase that. It's very unusual to get everyone that lives or works in a specific area to all agree to something, and that goes beyond farming to just anything, right? So I'm curious what the process was by which everyone came to the table and agreed to work together on this project.
So, yeah, I'll kind of provide a little, I guess, background on that. So when we first started this project, you know, one of the first things we did was just we had an informational meeting for the farmers within each of the watersheds back in the fall of 2009. And we really just wanted to run this project past them and talk about the monitoring and what we wanted to do with that and really garner their input and make sure that they were comfortable with what we were planning on doing. And in our conversations with some of the farmers in those watersheds is that it was very rewarding to just hear their genuine curiosity and their genuine interest in this study. Of course, there's always going to be some reservations, I think, from any of us that might partake in a project like this in terms of, you know, what are you going to do with the data? How is it going to be used? Is this going to result in additional regulations or additional enforcement? But always from the beginning, we really explained this project as a way to really help us all understand and learn together through this process of really, help address some of these questions about runoff in Southeast Minnesota, and also address some of their questions about, again, how effective our existing practices and you know, what is it going to take to reach some of these water quality goals that are set forth throughout the state. So I think the process of installing monitoring equipment at both the watersheds, small watershed scale, but also at the edge of field scale was really important. And over those 8 years of doing that, we've all learned a lot through that process. And that kind of, I think, provided the foundation for the next phase of the project, which was to work with farmers within those watersheds to implement additional practices. And one of the key things that we did is we, within each of those watersheds, we had what we call farmer leaders. And typically, most of these cases are, these are the farmers that actually we have edge of field monitoring taking place on their farms. And so they, of course, have intimate knowledge of all the monitoring that is going on, and they know exactly, you know, some of the numbers that we're seeing. So they've been very big advocates, you know, for the project itself as they've gone along through the project. And that, I think, really lended itself well and complemented to that second phase of the project, which was to conduct walkovers, which is what Ron was hired to do. And so through those meetings, frequently we would meet probably at least twice a year to go over data and review information. And that process led to sort of developing this walkover approach.
I'm glad that question came up because the landowners in these watersheds, you know, are significant stakeholders in water quality issues. And I would use that to my advantage when talking to these landowners, and it made them feel like a part of a group, like everybody had a little bit to give here to make this project work. And I think that even led to a lot of the projects going in, that they felt like they were all contributing and they all were together on this. And when they saw their neighbors implementing a new conservation practice, I think that just led to more and more and more, and they wanted to do their part. So that was a very important part of the project.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. So let's talk a little bit about these field walkovers. And I know, Ron, you really led the charge on this aspect of the project. So the idea being that you actually went out and looked at all the fields of these landowners within the watershed areas for areas where there might be potential for erosion or loss of nutrients. And that was kind of the focus. Now, I know you guys didn't just go in there blindly. You had maps, right, that gave you a pretty good sense of what areas of the field to look at first and all of that. Can you from both your perspectives, kind of talk about that tool, that that agricultural conservation planning framework tool, and what information it provided you and how you used it.
Yeah, so what we did is we, like I like to describe it, is we try to do as much of our homework as possible before, you know, talking about these walkovers. And, you know, we're fortunate in Minnesota to have a lot of really detailed elevation data. This is what we call LIDAR, and LIDAR data, which is just really, really detailed elevation data throughout the state. And over the years, various organizations have been developing tools, various computer tools that allow you to leverage that elevation data or that detailed elevation data. And one of them, as you mentioned, is the Ag Conservation Planning Framework, which is developed by the Ag Research Service. And basically what this does is just allows you to look at, you know, look at fields in terms of where there might be potential risk for soil loss or greater risk for soil loss, and also identify maybe potential practices that might fit on the landscape within those particular areas. So we created a series of maps from that, but also some other tools, one of them being the Stream Power Index, which is another tool that can be used that helps you identify where there's areas of concentrated flow. And we developed a lot of those maps, and then Ron and I would sit down and go through those maps, and that would be used as a basis for before he would go out and conduct these walkovers.
Can I ask just a question here to elaborate on that? So how sensitive is that LIDAR data? You know, like, so for instance, I'm regrading around my house, and it involves, you know, changing the elevation of soil around my house probably about a foot. Foot and a half, and then regrading backwards, you know, a foot lower in other areas. Would that be something? Could that LIDAR pick up something that little in terms of elevation, or how sensitive is it?
Yeah, so it's very sensitive. So it can pick up minute differences in elevation, and it's centimeters actually.
Wow.
Is what what the
so you can see rills potentially. With LIDAR?
Yeah, potentially, but it's I mean, like down here in Southeast Minnesota, you can see sinkholes, of course, very easily. And the benefit of the LIDAR data is it actually can strip away the surface vegetation. So for instance, tree cover, those types of things. So then you can actually get a better sense of the elevation. But to the naked eye, it's actually difficult to discern some of those differences. So that's why some of these tools that are being developed, they actually do a lot of that processing and allow you to easily visualize, let's say, where water may like to concentrate and may like to potentially cause additional erosion concern.
Right. And so those concentrated flow areas, when you use that term, you're basically saying in a field you got water kind of moving off the rounder parts of the field, and then you get in those low areas, and that's where water is going to concentrate and flow. So it's kind of along the lines of where your grass waterways are going to be, typically.
Yeah, yeah. And in Southeast Minnesota, that tended to be what we found, and we see this in the monitoring data as well, is that these concentrated flow areas are really, you know, those areas in the landscape that really are kind of like the conveyor belt, so to speak, that actually can move the soil off of your field. And if a grass waterway is not in place or other supporting practices are not in place, you know, those are the areas of the field that pose the greatest risk for actually delivery of those of the sediment and nutrients off of the field. And you know, based on the water quality data that we had and some of those tools like you mentioned, that was really critical for Ron when he went out and did the walkovers. And so when he was out looking at those fields, he was really honing in on those specific areas based on what was identified on those maps. So it was an efficient way for him to quickly, you know, really hone in on those particular areas and focus in on.
Yeah. So Ron, when you're you get out there, you're visiting with a landowner, you have these maps to give you some sense of where there might be potential for erosion. What specific things did you guys talk about with the landowners, and what specific things were you looking for in the fields when you're doing a walkover?
You know, before I started the walkover, I would visit with the landowners, and out of all the resources that Kevin gave me, all the mapping and different tools that I had to use, it was that Stream Power Index map that I would pull out and lay on the pickup hood or on the kitchen table and talk to the landowner about. And again and again, the landowners would agree, yes, I'm having trouble in that area, or maybe this area wasn't quite as bad. But those maps were so important to me because I could start my walkover process and head right to those areas, and they were spot on. They would even identify things that to the naked eye you probably wouldn't even pick up, because tillage tools had come through maybe and leveled out some of those concentrated flow areas. But once you had the map in front of you and you took a good look at it, you could pick them back out of there again. They may not be giving the landowner a problem at that particular time of the year or during that year, but during the course of time, that's where the problems were going to show up. And so it made my walkover process just much easier and much quicker, that I could go to those places that were having visible eroded problems, non-invisible, and even sediment deposits and stuff like that. So it just made my work so much faster.
Okay. And the specific things you really looked for in the field were formation of gullies or rills, or what were you really keyed in on?
That's right. I was keyed in on the visible erosion, and, mm-hmm. and like Kevin had mentioned, if you can see the erosion, it's too high. You can't make more topsoil that fast, as you're losing it. Yeah. You know, it can't sustain that kind of erosion, and so if you can see it, it's beyond tolerable limits. And so that's the thing that I was looking for most of the time, was visible erosion. But then I would look at the other smaller contributing factors like contouring and stuff coming into those watersheds and stuff. And so
just one of the things that really popped out when I'm looking at the data from this, all right, 2015, is that when you did the walkovers, or 2016?
Started in 2015.
15. All right. You walked 583 fields, over 8,000 acres, 3 months. So, did you start seeing waterways in your sleep?
Well, I know when I started the walkovers, because I'm very sensitive to what I'm doing on someone else's property when I'm going in to do a walkover and stuff like that. So when I started in 2015, it was early in the year, and I didn't want to cause any problems to the landowner, so I started a lot of that work by foot. I was on foot trying to cover those fields, and it was going pretty slow. And then once I got going, I started visiting with landowners, and I said, you know, I've got a ranger that I can bring that would really speed this process up for me a little bit, to be able to drive on there a little tenderly. And the landowners were very cordial in saying, that's fine. You know, they didn't see any problem with that. So that sped things up a little bit. But yes, when you say you're seeing waterways in your sleep, it does get to be to that point, because I've visited with a lot of landowners, and they know this. It's not just the identifying the waterways and discussing to them about putting projects in and then getting them to install a new waterway. It's every time you get these practices started on these fields and it rains a little bit, and then you have to go back in again and touch them up, and then you go back in again and you touch them up. I've been on waterway projects with landowners that have probably had to been repaired 4 or 5 times. And that's unnerving when you've got that much land opened up and you're trying to install new practices that are going to help. And in the meantime, you're seeing all this devastation going on. So once landowners have a practice like a new waterway established, they're very reluctant to go in there and damage it at any, because they know how long it took to get that thing constructed.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were doing these walkovers, what were the main issues that you saw that either needed repair or improvement? And on the flip side, what was really working well generally?
Most of the waterways in the area, you know, from a drive-by aspect, you can look at a lot of these fields and see the green grass growing in these concentrated flow areas and think to yourself that everything's working fine. But when you get on the land and you actually do the walkover process, a large portion of the waterways were not functioning properly. Were either running on both sides of the waterway, one side or the other, or just weren't deep enough. or they're just the vegetation wasn't good enough, and so it was just a variety of problems. But that was the major issue on most of the landscapes, where the grassed waterways were not functioning properly. The good things I saw were still a lot of the structures, the ponds that were holding back the flooding waters and stuff like that, were still operating well, and there were a lot of those in place. Just there's been a history of conservation in these watersheds, and you can see the practices that they had put in years back, whether they were terracing systems or contour strip systems or a variety of things, were still functioning pretty good. Just maybe needed a little touch up here and there, but I'd say for the most part, landowners, you know, are good stewards of the land, and you can just kind of see it, them trying to blend being able to make a living and still be good conservation stewards, you know, and taking care of things. So but they are doing a good job, and I saw a lot of that when I was out doing the walkovers.
Yeah, I would just add that I think what was really interesting, you know, in the conclusion of Ron doing these walkovers is that, you know, every single producer and farmer that Ron worked with, they all had a variety of practices that they were using, ranging from contouring to terraces to waterways. But on the flip side, every farmer had at least one or two areas on their farm that poses a high risk for runoff and could utilize some additional attention. What's really remarkable, and again, it's a testament to these farmers and these study watersheds, but we're so thankful for them to allow us to do this and allow us to do this walkover. And what's remarkable is out of the roughly 50 farmers within these three watersheds, 100% of them allowed Ron to go on to their property and do this walkover assessment. And that really is asking a lot, because I use the analogy, it's like allowing someone to come into your home and snoop around and sort of tell you maybe what you're doing right and what you might be doing wrong. And how you approach that and how you have that conversation with the farmer is really important, right? And like Ron said, you know, all the farmers, they want to do the right thing and they want to minimize loss. And as many of our farmers tell us, you know, they're paying for the nutrients or they purchased that soil one way or another and they want to keep it there. And so, but what was really remarkable too, I would say another thing with the walkovers is that of the 100% of the farmers that participated, 70% of those farmers have been working with Ron and the local soil and water districts and other conservation organizations to help to install additional practices, to basically, you know, kind of heed what Ron had recommended and pick and choose some of those practices to address some of the high runoff risk areas. And that's really a remarkable number. And I think the other thing is, I would say about, it's looking like about 30% of those farmers actually went above and beyond and fixed 100% of their resource needs on their farm. And some of those farmers used public cost share assistance and some of them didn't. They just did it out of pocket. And so, again, I think it just kind of shows that you know, if approached the right way and if done the right way, that you can have a really high success in terms of participation. And the reason why that was so important to get those really high numbers is if we are able to measure the actual improvements of in water quality at the small watershed scale, we need a very high density and intensity of practices to actually measure that. So
why is that? Is that just because there's always going to be some level of variability, or what's the reason?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing, is that there's just so many variables at the watershed scale that are affecting the water and runoff. Of course, climate being the biggest one and the amount of precipitation. And so for us to actually measure that and see that, yes, there was a statistically significant improvement in the water quality, we need many years of data, but we also have to say that, yes, we address many of these critical areas within the watersheds. So, yeah, that's probably the biggest reason. And
So in other words, you know, you might be able to, and we'll talk about the edge of field sites, but you might be able to measure, you know, if I put in an extra waterway here, This reduces the sediment, or I convert to CRP. This reduces the sediment loss and phosphorus loss this much at the edge of that field. But because there's so much variability in weather and just kind of random things happening across the watershed, you might not see that impact in the water itself unless you have a whole lot of people doing it. Is that kind of a...
That's correct. Okay. Yep. Yeah. And not only that, but making sure that we're targeting the right practices in the right place at the right time. And that was one of the key things through the walkover process was really prioritizing and targeting practices, which kind of gets into this whole concept of what we call critical source areas. These are areas of the landscape that yield a disproportionate amount of the sediment or nutrient loss. And so those were the areas that we're really trying to target in this study. And by doing that, of course, that can be more of a better cost benefit, right? So you're spending money where you're going to get hopefully the biggest bang for your buck in those watersheds. Another factor that a reason why you need a high density of practices, and especially those critical source areas, is as you move up in scale, so move from the field scale to the watershed scale, there's a lag time effect. That, you know, just because we put this practice in doesn't mean that we turn that source off, that it takes time. It may take several years before you can measure that over time. And so that's another factor as well.
Okay. We'll move into the edge of field data here in just a minute. But I had just one more question. So from your background, doing all these walkovers and having done that sort of conservation work for a long time. If I'm a farmer, and let's say I'm sitting in my truck, you know, at the bottom of the field, looking up grass waterway, looking up my field, what sort of things do I need to be looking for to make sure my conservation practices are working? And do I need to get out in that field and really walk it very closely?
I don't know if getting out in the field and walking it closely, because these landowners work this land every year and they know exactly where they're having problems, and that was another thing that I made sure that I listened, you know, when I went over the walkover reports with these landowners, because they work this field every year, they know exactly what their challenges are and stuff, and they may be having problems in a whole different area of the field than what I picked out as a top priority. So listening was a huge factor. Kevin brought up about the numbers of landowners that participated, you know, and the things that we've got going on in that project. And I think a lot of that success for me when I did the walkovers was the fact that I've been there. You know, I farmed for many years. I know the things that those landowners are up against, whether it's weather or financial or personal dynamics and things like that. So I think that helped my success quite a bit, knowing exactly what they were up against. And you know, when we're sitting there looking at those grass waterways, I've been on that land and I've seen what's going on there, which I can share with them, but they know what's going on in their farms.
Okay.
All right, that about does it for part one of this podcast. We're going to take a quick break and then come back for part two, so be sure to tune into that. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFRAC, for supporting this podcast. For the latest information on nutrient management, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT, where you can also send us your questions for future podcast episodes. Thanks for listening.